have read it in newspapers and special magazine articles and Sunday supplements, but the Russians are going capitalist, and they seem to care a whole lot. There's a real sense of joy. I don't know why exactly. Is it a sense of, ha-ha, we were right all along, or belief that as they go capitalist, they will start supporting us and stop fighting us? I don't know, but the Russians certainly do not say they are going capitalist. They vigorously and vehemently deny it. The people who accuse them of it are the Americans, for one, and the Chinese, for two. And this morning, let's try to see why. After Stalin's death in 1952, the problems of a Stalinist-type economy began to be openly discussed in Russia. A Stalinist-type economy is a term widely used in the West simply to describe the attempt to control the whole economy by means of central command. The model here is a pyramid. Way up at the top, there's the people who make the big decisions, and then they delegate authority for making the next decision down to a lower echelon. And then they delegate authority for making more detailed decisions down to a still lower echelon. But in principle, everything that is in response to orders that come from somebody above, from somebody above, and somebody above, and the whole thing, the orders all radiate out from an apex up the top. And that's what's meant by a Stalinist-type economy. Central command. Strong central planning. Well, central planning, in some sense, always was a Marxist aim. Marx doesn't talk a whole lot about what the socialist or communist society will look like, but there can be no doubt that he assumed the economic system would be run by some kind of central planning. It was assumed because Marx was terribly impressed with the anarchy of capitalism. And when capitalism disappeared, that anarchy would disappear, and something rational, something planned would be put into place. But Marx never gave the details much thought, and neither did Lenin. Both of them, I think it's fair to say, had some rather ridiculously low estimates of the number of important administrative decisions that would have to be made by central planners and their subordinates. I mean, Marx never gives a number, or Lenin either, but if you had asked them, they probably would have thought, well, every day you'd have to make about a dozen important administrative decisions. And that just ain't so at all. Every day you have to make many thousands of important administrative decisions. Why didn't they see this? I think it's because they were so obsessed by the notion that the capitalist economy is anarchical and atomistic that they were blinded to the very real and important mechanisms of order that operate in a capitalist economy, and it would stop operating once socialism was introduced. I mean, they didn't see how much order was built into the capitalist system. Hence, they didn't see that when they started socialism, they were going to need, they were going to be suspending this mechanism of order, and so they were going to have to make an awful lot of decisions they had to count on. What Marx and Lenin saw was that under capitalism, every producer does what he pleases. What they did not see was that each producer does what he pleases under very many constraints. In the first place, he wants to make profit. He's got to make a profit. He won't remain a producer for too long. And that means he has to produce something that people want. And it has to be produced at a cost low enough so that he can sell it at a price people are willing to pay and still make that profit. And that isn't the easiest thing in the world to do, especially when he is competing with other producers of the same, similar, or wholly different product, competing both for consumers and for resources. I mean, resources don't come free. You got to go out and bid those resources away from other producers who would also like to use them. Now, in this process of competing for consumers and competing for resources, prices get established. Prices get established for everything, from labor to wing nuts. And these prices become each producer's information signal. I don't know what you think prices are in a capitalist economy, but that's the most important thing they are, information signals. The housewife uses Price as an information ticket. He heads down to the grocery store to get a dozen oranges and then sees the price, 79 cents a pound. And all of a sudden it hits her, a pound? They used to be 79 cents a dozen. She puts an orange in the scale and finds that it's a pound and a half and shifts to apples. The price was a signal. So as a result of this, I'll just say this and go on, but it's important to understand what's happening. If some uncontrollable factor, let's say a revolution in some African country that supplies copper, some factor like this results in a 30% reduction in the supply of copper, it is not necessary under capitalism to send a memo out to each copper user telling him to cut his use of copper by 30%. You don't have to do that. In fact, it wouldn't even be sensible to do so. Because if you are interested in the public welfare, what you really want is for those producers who use copper to produce essential products, you want them to keep on producing. And you want those producers who are using copper in the production of trivial products, non-essential, less important, less urgently wanted products, you want them to cut back more than 30%. So, you know, just telling everybody to cut back 30% isn't the right way to do it. But in any event, capitalism doesn't require any kind of memos like this. In capitalism, the price of copper will rise, inducing each user to economize in the best way, in the light of his situation. And that price will keep rising until these induced economies have, in the aggregate, cut the use of copper by 30%. And that all happens automatically. The point is that under capitalism, which is an economy with private ownership of resources organized by the market, there is tremendous economizing on information. A capitalist system gets by without anybody really knowing very much. You know, that's worth thinking about. The Russians have always had to employ large numbers of statisticians just to make their economic system function at all. And our economic system can function with no statisticians. Nobody has to know how much there is of anything. Nobody has to know how much there ought to be of anything. Everybody just responds on the basis of a very limited amount of information, mostly prices, plus what he knows about his immediate situation, and he acts. And the whole thing is coordinated through the mechanism of the market, through these prices continually changing as people feed into the market their wants and information about what they got to offer. Well, when the government comes along now and abolishes the market, as socialism does, abolishes most of it. First, the Bolsheviks wanted to abolish the whole thing. So this is the grand socialist myth, that we would get rid of money and we would have exchange in kind. You know, people would just, the workers would produce things in their factories and then they would put them on the shelves and then they would go into the store, they would see other things on the shelves and they would take them up. It's a wild type thing, but that was the original thing. But anyhow, the government did abolish the market, and that meant that the government had to provide all of the instructions that formerly went out automatically. And the government was going to have to accumulate mountains of data as a basis for issuing these instructions. Now, Marx and Lenin never saw this. That's the first thing to remember. Stalin found it out. And Stalin rose to the occasion, as you know, with heroic measures. He executed and exiled people for what were, in essence, deficiencies of his own economic system. Because his system was tremendously inefficient at getting information out, at getting instructions out, Stalin sent people to Siberia and shot them. They weren't doing what he wanted done. And he called it sabotage. But it wasn't sabotage, it was ignorance. The enterprise director, he wanted like crazy to do what was for the Russian motherland, but he didn't know what it was. But as the Soviet economy grew under Stalin's forced industrialization program, the problem that I'm talking about grew exponentially. Suppose that doubling the size of the economy doubles the number of variables that have to be controlled. Then the number of relationships among those variables that are going to have to be controlled and coordinated will quadruple.
That means that a four-fold increase in gross national product will yield a 16-fold increase in Excedrin headache for central planning. It's similar to the problem that the telephone company faces. You know, the telephone industry is an industry of decreasing returns to scale or increasing costs, because when you've only got, say, you've just got two people on the system, and you add a third one, how many connections do you have to make? And because you add the third one, it's two new connections. But when you've got 1 million people in the area, and you add one more customer, you've got to make 1 million new connections. And it gets pretty thorny. Well, in the 50s, in the 1950s, it became clear to many people in Russia, and they began saying it after Stalin was dead, because Stalin didn't like people to say things like this, it became clear that attempting to control too much from the center would lead to controlling too little. One distinguished Soviet economist put it, that perhaps the only way that we can make central planning a reality is to abandon central planning. Now, what he meant by that was that, you know, if you try to hold all of the apples in the barrel in your arms, walk with them, you're going to wind up holding no apples whatsoever. It was leading to something that, I guess it's been aptly called hurrah planning, where you plan, but the only purpose of the plan is to give people something to cheer about. And we announce, here's the new 5-year plan, everybody says, hurrah, hurrah! But it doesn't control anything. Nobody acts in accord with the plan, because the plan is inconsistent, incoherent, impracticable, unenforceable. So the Russians began looking for ways to decentralize their economy. There were two big reforms, one in 1957, one in 1965. We can just think a moment about the one in 1957. It was a complete failure. This was Khrushchev's big hope. Khrushchev thought that maybe the way to decentralize was to abandon these all-union ministries. You know, essentially, the way the system ran was that everything, every industry, every productive activity was placed in a ministry. I mean, if you were making metal sculpture, you went perhaps in the all-union ministry of the art, or maybe in the all-union metallurgical industry. I don't know, there's always a problem. These things got shifted around continually, but and there were many of these ministries. Now, somebody in Moscow who was the commissar for that ministry was responsible finally for sending out all of the orders that would get down to the bottom, and then over the commissars was the Communist Party. And of course that was tremendous centralization, and it wasn't working. So Khrushchev thought that what he would do is abolish most of those all-union ministries and substitute sort of a state right or state control, something they called Sovnarkozy. The main responsibility now for planning the economy was delegated to Sovnarkozy. There were about 104 of these, organized on a regional basis. And so instead of all the orders coming down from Moscow, the orders now would come from your Sovnarkoz. Well, that wasn't the answer, because though it did solve some problems, you know, it meant that this long chain of command wasn't long anymore. There was a whole new problem created, and that was the problem of coordinating activity among the Sovnarkoz. Now, who's in charge of seeing to it that the 104 Sovnarkozy work together? If here's Sovnarkoz in a portion of the Ukraine that's making some decisions, it is not, that Sovnarkoz is not completely independent. It needs things from other Sovnarkoz. It's going to sell things to other Sovnarkoz. And who's going to make sure that all of these things mesh? The system gradually developed all sorts of bugs, and it was becoming clear in the early 1960s that there were more bugs in Khrushchev's system than there had been in Stalin's system, and that was one of the reasons why Khrushchev went on to greener pastures. So the debate resumed early in the 60s, becoming very intense around 1962 with the publication of a number of really quite radical articles in leading Soviet economics journals. And it developed that the Soviets were contemplating four alternatives. One was, I call it, screw it up tighter. That is to say, All right, the system of central planning with orders coming down from the top to everybody isn't working. It isn't working because we're not working at it hard enough. You know, you call this the kind of the shoe thumping approach. We do this all the time. When the congregation isn't displaying life and vitality, then we get out there and we nag, let's have some life and vitality. We got to do better. Most meetings, whether they're teachers or preachers or businessmen, probably have this as a goal. Screw up the system tighter. There were some people who believed that was really possible. These people always entertained at the back of their mind the idea that the reason the system didn't work was because people weren't trying, or they weren't patriotic, or you know, something like that. It's a failure of will. A second proposal that was made was to use computers plus very complicated systems of analysis, particularly something called input-output analysis, to bring the whole thing under control. And the mathematicians and engineers were all gung-ho this. I won't go into the details of this, but they were talking about, now that the Soviet Union is wealthy, it could afford the computers, and it was gradually acquiring the trained personnel to use them and to get the data. Stalin, it would work in this new utopia, as somebody has called it, would be a thoroughly centralized command system that would work because the orders could be passed down more quickly, the data necessary to formulate intelligent orders could be brought up more accurately and quickly. So in other words, it's Stalin plus a computer. That's what some are hoping for. Then a third proposal, and this was the most radical proposal, but it was put forward by a number of the most distinguished economists in the Soviet Union, all of whom are still alive. And, well, one of them died of natural death. But they have not, it's interesting, their views have been rejected and today are under considerable criticism. Their patriotism is today being called in question, but they're still working and respected. Some were proposing to tell all enterprise directors to maximize their profits and then let prices be set by supply and demand. That sounds familiar. But this was not the notion that was adopted. The scheme that was adopted in 1965, the new economic system, as it was called, adopted by resolution of the Communist Party, the Central Committee of the Communist Party, on September 29th, 1965, was essentially this, that all enterprises would establish more accurate accounting procedures so that they would have better information on the ruble value of their sales and the ruble value of the inputs that they use. And then enterprise directors would be given some additional freedom, they said a lot more freedom to determine on their own, without orders from above, such things as output mix. In other words, if you're a nail producer, you decide for yourself how many big nails, how many little nails, heavy nails, nails with flat heads, round heads, you know, and all that sort of stuff. The input mix, I mean, are you going to use a lot of labor and little machinery, or little machinery and a lot of labor? The wage rate structure, the suppliers upon whom you will draw. You see, formerly all these things were determined. This was a part of the central planning system. You were told what to produce. You were told within limits, because there are always limits here, what your output mix should be. You were told to produce so many big nails, so many little nails. It never worked very well. A lot of fun stories having to do with that. You were told what wage rates you would pay. You were told how many workers you could hire, how many workers you could hire of each grade very often. You were told from whom you obtained all your supplies. You were told exactly to whom you would sell your product. All these things were specified. And there were success indicators related to all of these things to see whether you were doing a good job. In other words, if you were told that you could only have so much aluminum, you were also given a success indicator so that you got brownie points and a bonus at the end of the year if you didn't use more aluminum than that and, in fact, used 5% less. And these success indicators had multiplied all over the place. So now the idea was to remove most of the success indicators and give the enterprise director far more freedom, let profitability be the dominant success indicator. The most important thing for an enterprise director to do is to make a profit. And then the third thing was to make more use of financial incentives for the firm, the managers, and the workers. I mean, so in the Soviet Union, the enterprise provides, if the enterprise has funds, it can provide a lot of things that make the lives of its employees and its managers more interesting. It can get some equipment that it would like. It can maybe install an air conditioning system in the workers' lounge. It can build better housing for workers. The profits of a firm, a portion of them, can be diverted to the provision of housing for workers. But then, in addition to that, the enterprise fund was to be used to pay out bonuses, both to managers and to production line employees. This was called the Leninist system of material incentives. And as the September resolution of the Central Committee of the Communist Party put it, we are adopting the Leninist principle of material incentives, which decrees that it shall be in the interest of each person to do what is in the interest of the country as a whole. Which sounds like Adam Smith to me. How did this 1965 reform work out? How has it worked out? By the way, this is the reform associated with the name of Lieberman. I'm sure you've heard of the name of Lieberman and Liebermanism. Yevsei Lieberman, a Russian economist and statistician who's really pretty second rate. He probably was not the originator of these ideas, but was used as a stalking horse, we'll let old dummy Yevsei write the articles, but there were other people behind it. It's pretty clear that Lieberman is not the originator of these proposals. But these reforms, or Liebermanism as it's called anyway, are what have given rise to the charge in the United States and China that the USSR is today moving toward capitalism. And in the United States, it seems, just judging by the things I read and hear, what impresses most Americans with Russia's drift toward capitalism is this emphasis on profitability. You know, profit is a sacred word for us, and we think that any country which is stressing profit must be going capitalist. I don't know why we assume that, but we do. And the thing that has most bothered the Chinese, and it caused the Chinese to accuse the Russians of taking the capitalist road, is their increased reliance on financial incentives for individuals. But I think the most important thing to be said about all of this is that the post-1965 reforms have turned out to be a maze of contradictions. And their net effect, after almost 5 years, has been very little. And there have been few substantial changes in Montana. Why? Number of reasons. In the first place, there is just the fact of the inertia of any large bureaucracy. It is easier to announce changes than to affect changes. Evidence for this is found all over the place in the Soviet press. The Central Committee of the Communist Party decrees that profitability shall be the success indicator, and that the party and ministry officials should stop imposing upon enterprise directors all of these other success indicators. Well, what if the party officials and the ministry officials don't stop? What do you do? Suppose your company hands down a directive saying, you shall be free to do such and such, but your immediate supervisor doesn't like that directive. What's he going to do? He's going to keep you from, because he's the guy who's going to report on you. He's the guy who's going to recommend your promotion. And you just can't go against him. So that's one reason. The reforms have not been wholeheartedly accepted. And it's been very difficult to move the bureaucracy. But related to this is something else that may turn out in the long run to be more important. And that is that the Communist Party officials, once you get below the very top level, have had very strong personal reasons for fighting these reforms. And that's because under the old Stalinist system, the local party official had a very important job to do. He was the guy who was always snooping around to make sure that what the party demanded was being done. There was a good communist usually attached to every enterprise. Dr. Zhivago, the movie Dr. Zhivago, the book that, did you see the movie? You remember that there were these, when Zhivago was captured by this band of troops, there seemed to be two men in charge. One of them knew military tactics, and the other one knew Marxist dogma. And that was an idea that the Bolsheviks thought was necessary in running everything. You had to have somebody who was technically competent and somebody who was ideologically competent. And that passed over into their industrial system, too. So that the idea they had, at least in the beginning, was that every factory would be run by a man who knew engineering and a man who knew Marx. Well, this got changed over the years, particularly as the engineers went to school themselves and learned Marx and supposedly were now ideologically pure. But the notion never disappeared that it was the task of the party officials who were the most adept in Marxist thinking to keep a close watch on everything that was going on and be sure that nuts and bolts were being produced in a Marxist fashion. So this made the local Communist Party official a pretty big wheel. Moreover, the enterprises in his area, what he would call his enterprises, were always running into problems. And the Russian economy for years and years was a seller's market, meaning you couldn't get anything. You could always get rid of things, but you couldn't get the things you wanted. So you had to have influence. And the party officials became some of the leading pushers or influence peddlers or I can get it for you wholesale type of guys. And they had to be leaned on. Again, they were big men.
Yeah.
They were the guys who got called when things went wrong. Now, this new system, with its attempt to put more power in the hands of enterprise directors and give enterprise directors more freedom to determine things for themselves, meant, well, what happened to the Communist Party official? This, to the extent to which the reforms were designed to reduce the power and importance of the bureaucracy, it was reducing the power and importance of the hundreds of thousands of Communist Party officials who really were responsible for, well, who had a tremendous amount of power over the way things got done out in the boondocks. And they've had their heels dug in since 1965. And this sounds very opportunistic on their part. They didn't argue it this way. They didn't say, we're opposed to these reforms because it reduces our power. They said, we are opposed to these reforms because this looks like capitalism to us. They have been the principal ideological opponents of the reform. But I suspect that the reason is not ideological objection so much as it is opportunistic objection. But there's a third thing that impeded the success of the reforms, and that is the refusal of the Soviet Union to accept the logic of its own reforms. If prices reflect real scarcity relationships, then profitability should be the only success indicator. The only thing that an enterprise director should be told is maximize your profits, nothing else. If prices do not reflect real scarcity relationships, then the enterprise director should not be told to pay any attention to profitability whatsoever. Now, what the Russians have done is fallen in the middle of all these stools. They have recognized the need for price reform. They realize that if prices do not reflect actual scarcity in the economy, it doesn't make much sense to tell enterprise directors to maximize profits because they're maximizing profits on the basis of meaningless information. So they've called for price reform, but they have refused to adopt price reform procedures that would yield the kinds of prices that they want, that they need. They have simultaneously stressed profitability. They talked a lot about profitability. They cheered as each new set of enterprises, each industry went on to the new economic system. And then they talk about how profits went up now under this new system. And there's a lot of talk about profitability. But they have hedged profitability about with all sorts of other success indicators. In other words, they've told the enterprise director, profitability is going to be the big criterion. But in practice, because they recognize that their price system is irrational, they've constrained him continually. And now they're adding constraints all the time. All kinds of other success indicators. You will maximize your profit, but subject to the following three constraints, which become four, five, six, seven, and they're just gradually drifting back to the old system. A lot of authorities, Western authorities in the Soviet Union, are today predicting that as the failures of the system mount, and they are mounting, frustration is going to increase, and the frustration level is pretty high, judging by the Soviet press now. And so the Russians will, in a few years, go to some new system, which will probably be a combination of nagging and computers. But so they're not going capitalist. And let me ask the question in conclusion, who cares whether they are or not? As I say, a lot of Americans seem to feel it's a terribly important question, and that our side is winning in the home stretch if the Russians are going capitalist. But let us always remember, countries do not love us in direct proportion as they diverge from a socialist economic system. There are countries with capitalist economic systems that do not like us, and there are countries with socialist economic systems that don't have anything against us, and unless we make a big issue out of it, or they make a big issue out of it, there's no reason why socialist countries have to get along with socialist countries better than they get along with capitalist countries. At least I don't see any reason. I think what we should, and I also don't think that we should chuckle with glee every time the Soviet Union falls on its face. Seems to me that a rich and successful USSR is a non-boat rocking USSR. Another thing, should be said, the 1965 reforms, it is now apparent, have no connection with political liberalization. People have used the phrase the liberalization of the Soviet Union in reference to the 1965 reforms. Well, I don't know now exactly why you should call that liberalization. I would call it an attempt at decentralization. But you probably know that there was, simultaneously with this, a political flaw going on in the Soviet Union, more freedom for writers, for example, and for critics of the regime. But that has ended. And the writers are again being booted out of the Writers' Congress and going to prison for writing things that 3-4 years ago they could get away with. The repression's been coming down hard again. And it seems, in fact, that the more problems that the Russians run into in their economy and in their international relations, the less likely is political liberalization at home. And it's kind of a general rule for countries. The worse things are going, the more you crack down on these people. Well, all right, long speech. I quit.
No, I agree with you. It would be nice to have Russia, a well-fed and well-to-do nation, because if you look back, you can see that the hungry nation is the most dangerous thing. That the hungry army is the most dangerous thing.
No, I'd qualify that. I think that a real hungry nation is not dangerous. A real hungry one.
Well,
and a real rich nation is not dangerous. The ones in the middle that are dangerous.
Well,
don't you think so?
The hungry army is the ones that went out and start back with old Genghis Khan. Why did he go on the largest conquest of history?
I don't know, but I bet it wasn't because he was hungry.
It's because they were getting hungry fast. They had to depart from the
their homeland to find fodder for their new nomadic people that have to feed the animals that died to death. No, he didn't have it. He just put together these tribes and their horses and that. And then they had a small drought, you know, and the horses were going to die, so they went out and took other people's land. They found out they were pretty good at it, so they kept on going.
They were back in the
They just burn them down and make taxes out of them.
Well, maybe we better leave Genghis Khan. Sorry, I just, you know, I'll buy you.
Just why Albania and China seem to be so much alike in their philosophy with opposed republics, the headquarters, or anything.
Well, they just take Albania. It just happens that the people in firm control of the Albanian Communist Party did not buy at any time the so-called revisionist line. They were committed Stalinists. They didn't believe in a bunch of things that the Russians were beginning to think about seriously in the 1950s and 60s. The most important, well, it's hard to say. One thing the Albanians didn't believe in was any kind of decentralization that made use of financial incentives. They also didn't think that Stalin was such a bad guy. The real beginnings of the Albanian break with the Soviet Union, the Albanian abandonment of the Soviet bloc, came after the Khrushchev de-Stalinization speech. That was a crisis. Perhaps more in many of the East European countries than it was in the Soviet Union. Because these guys, there were little Stalins still around in these East European countries. Now all of a sudden, the rug is pulled out from under them. They've been doing the things they've been doing in the name of Stalin, pointing to Stalin's example and all of that. And then Khrushchev says Stalin was a saint. And that really began upsetting the leadership of communist parties in the Soviet Union. In Eastern Europe. But Albania just said, baloney. And they remained firm.
There wasn't a real particular economic reason for this. It was more of a political.
I think it was more political. If you look for an economic reason, the most important economic reason, they did reject the notion that individual financial incentives could be used to build socialism. But
why did one country would have to do this and not the other? That was Stalin looking on Albania more favorably during his time?
No. I think in part it was just the relative strength of the officials. You know, they in Albania they did what they could get away with. As the winds of liberalization began to blow through Eastern Europe, it was just tougher to control them in Hungary and Poland and East Germany and Czechoslovakia than it was to control them in Albania, Bulgaria, and Romania. Those three countries are among the most backward in the Soviet bloc: Albania, Hungary, Albania, Romania, and Bulgaria. And these have been the three countries least affected by the winds of change. But they've all moved in different directions. Romania has gone radical in just one way, demanding international independence of the Soviet Union. But its economy is still very Stalinist. Bulgaria doesn't do much of anything. It doesn't pay attention to anything that's changing. Bulgaria is very backward, kind of out of it. There's a lower level of literacy in these countries. The Western traditions of liberal democracy have reached into Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary and East Germany in ways that they never reached down into Albania and Bulgaria and Romania. I think that's the principal explanation for this. Yeah.
I suspect that there's probably even on this. You've mentioned that we find in our press and our media
tend to believe as you see Russia becoming more and more capitalist. We find the main thing in their literature as they look at our system and find us becoming more and more socialist. Which also brings me to a second point. In the more recent reforms in Russia, in which we talk about the order to go out to maximize profit, but one of the difficulties there is subject to now, obviously, we find the same thing in this country. We don't prevent the market and so we don't let the railroad charge whatever they want to charge. We don't respect the just principle of scarcity in so many areas of our economic life. So is it the question of, you know, what are the intelligences doing? Now, you didn't sell them off, and I'm sure this is not a place where you could sell off the restraints that they put on maximizing profits. But do we really find our two systems emerging? In the sense, the issues now are where do we interfere with the market in welfare legislation and maximizing certain aspects of our economy? Mm-hmm. Isn't that, are those the questions now that both of us are continually being frustrated by?
Let me ask you, try to answer your second question first with a quantitative statement that's obviously going to be furious. Quantitative accuracy, but you get the point across. I would say that in the United States, scarcity relationship, as determined by the interplay of supply and demand in reasonably open and competitive markets, determines 95% of the allocation decisions that are made. In other words, 95% of the decisions that get made are responses to profit maximization in an appropriate context. In the Soviet Union, it's 5%. Now, there's just a world, that's all the difference in the world. Those are two radically different systems. It means that in our system, you can, you know, sure, we have constraints also, but the constraints don't really follow us up too badly because they really are quite minor, all things considered. The places where we intervene, we very often intervene simply to underwrite what the market says. Like minimum wage legislation is a good example. Every now and then Congress increases the federal minimum wage law and kind of tries to push it up to what is sort of the going market minimum right now. But in the Soviet Union, the constraints are so numerous and so interfering that, and prices are just established in totally different, except for very, very few commodities. Supply and demand just isn't allowed to have anything to say about prices. The Russians still retain the old Marxist notion that prices should be determined by cost of production, and cost of production is primarily labor value embodied in the product. Well, if you begin with a dogma like that, then you've had it. You can't get rational prices. Now, in are we moving together? I just don't think so, because of that enormous difference. I don't think that we're going to, you know, despite all the complaints about we're going down the socialist road and all of that, I don't buy it. I don't think we are. I think we've moved to, I do happen to think the government does interfere too much in economic life, not just the federal government, state and local. They're doing all kinds of silly, idiotic things, and I'd like to see them stop a lot of it, primarily supporting monopolies and creating monopolies. But I don't think we're anywhere near socialism. And the Russians, as they introduce a little, introduce profitability as a criterion for decision making by enterprise directors, they're doing that in a context that is so different from one in which the market could effectively operate that I don't think they're anywhere near anything that could be called capitalism. Now, your very first question was, are there writers in the Soviet Union who notice with glee that we're moving towards socialism? A few. One is this guy that I keep seeing these books back around by Sakharov, Progress, Coexistence, and Intellectual Freedom, that paperback book. He's one who does this. There are very, very few Soviet writers who do this because it's still official dogma. Sakharov is a heretic, and he's going to get his one of these days very quickly. I also happen to think he's very shallow. I mean, he's a good nuclear physicist, and he ought to stay there. He really doesn't understand anything he's writing about. But it is heresy to suggest that the United States is moving towards socialism, as it isn't heresy in the United States to suggest the Soviet Union is moving towards socialism.
Have you ever been to the
No, I haven't. Oh, yeah. Did you speak Russian?
No.
I've always found in traveling in a foreign country that if I didn't speak the language, people were most reluctant to talk to me.
One question I must ask in Germany, how is he carrying under the system after the new system?
You mean under the new economic system?
Well, under the Soviet satellite.
Yeah.
It seems to me a free people like Germany would have an awful hard time to adjust to the Soviet system.
Yeah, if a free people like Germany, remember Hitler took over Germany in the early 1930s and was in charge until 1945, and then the Russians took over. When was the last time that the East Germans knew freedom?
Well, as far as the market and economics,
well, they were used to capitalism, okay, and used to a system private for ownership of resources and with prices set in the marketplace. Yeah, they were used to that, but that's funny thing. There's very little wholehearted sympathy for private ownership of resources with prices set in the market anywhere in the world, even in the United States. Now, we all say we're for capitalism, we're for private property, but very few people are willing to have prices set by supply and demand. They're willing to let prices be set by supply and demand as long as the prices that I want high are high and the ones I want low are low. But we're continually calling in the cops to try to get those prices fixed. And all our talk about fair prices, and there's an awful lot of this kind of talk. For example, I was talking to some people the other day about the problem of wage scales for high school teachers, and I made the statement that we ought to, since we couldn't get enough physics teachers, and we had an overabundance of history teachers, we ought to pay physics teachers more and pay history teachers less. And the answer was that wouldn't be fair. That's not right. Everybody should receive the same pay for the same work. Well, they aren't doing the same work. One's teaching physics, one's teaching history, but they're both same kind of people. They went to college the same number of years. So you got old cost of production theory in here. You really believe that the price of something should be determined basically by the amount of labor embodied in it? We're all good Marxists way down in our hearts. Now, I'm stressing this because I think when a government comes along and suspends the operation of the market, the great majority of people say, hoorah, hoorah. You don't. Now that they get mad when they find out that they can't do some of the things they want to do, you know, when they discover that under this new system, they got to fill out three forms to get a candy bar, or the things that they used to buy all the time now can't be purchased. Then they begin to get angry, but they don't see that the cause of they don't relate their problem to the decision to suspend the operation of the market. They blame it on corrupt bureaucrats or bungling, mindless fools, and what it all comes to is that I don't think that there's very little evidence that there was any real strong opposition to the establishment of socialism in East Germany. Now, as it became apparent, there was strong opposition to the establishment of Russian rule. I think they were more nationalistic than capitalistic. In the original East German workers' revolt, it was as much directed against. It was directed against management per se. Workers always dislike management, and when the management is called socialist, that doesn't really change the situation.
It's also directed against the fact that the Russians were in control. And the number, the people who always left East Germany, I think, were mostly people who were just looking for a better life. And it was obvious that there was a better life available in West Germany. But now, East Germany has been one of the countries to carry the new economic system along quite far. And I don't keep up with East Germany as much as I try to keep up with some of the other countries in the Soviet bloc. They seem to be having relative success. It's possible that East Germany will carry through the logic of this reform. And I would say the test of the countries of willingness to carry through the logic of the 1965 reforms is their willingness to say, we will let prices be established by supply and demand. If they're not willing to say that, they don't accept the logic of their own position. East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and of course Yugoslavia has gone far beyond all of this. Just take those three. They have established categories of commodities. Some commodities whose prices would be centrally determined. Some commodities whose prices would be established by supply and demand within limits that were centrally determined. And some prices that would be free to fluctuate up and down on the open market. Now, if they evolve in the direction of pushing more and more prices into those latter categories, then it seems to me they're accepting the logic of the reform. East Germany may make it. But here, political questions always come in. Can they do this and still retain the notion that they're a socialist country? And if they can't retain the belief that they're a socialist country, that creates a kind of crisis of faith that will be politically subversive. If you're not a socialist country, then how can you call, how can you demand, well, if you're not a socialist country, then you're not opposed to all them capitalist countries. Then you're not being encircled by all them capitalist countries. Then you don't have to have that wall down there. All kinds of new thoughts begin stirring that are politically dangerous. As they did in Czechoslovakia, and they stirred so rapidly and so dangerously that the Russians sent in tanks.
Would the life of the average Russian worker be any different under this new system than it was under the old system?
It is different, yeah. It's different in some ways that don't make the workers very happy. For one thing, one of the most important powers that the enterprise directors got under this new system was the power to lay workers off. And they used that power. And unemployment has appeared in the Soviet Union. And that workers don't like that. There have been a lot of complaints. I mean, about the only way I keep up with this is I read digests, and information supplements summarizing what's being written in various Soviet newspapers and magazines. And you get an awful lot of complaints that the bonuses that were supposed to appear under the new system aren't being shared with the workers, that the managers are taking the bonuses. The workers are bearing the risk and the managers are getting the reward. A lot of complaints about this.
But I mean, one of the things they could do was use money for housing, for the low housing, you know, or just the housing, and have them use money for the person for the living
condition. Well, I don't, they've used some of it, I don't know how much, the little articles here and there, but housing is still bad in Russia. It's going to take a long, long time to improve it. There just isn't enough to go around.
Their system finds no place for price subsidies.
No place, you think? You got nothing but price subsidies. I'm not sure. I guess I don't understand. But
I mean, paying a man to not go weak.
Oh, no, yeah. No, they don't have to pay anybody to not do something, especially grow wheat. No, but of course, their subsidies are, the system is shot through with subsidies. So. Yeah, half their prices are subsidized, and the other half are overtaxed.
In the areas in which they do respect the natural nitrogen crop, what happens when the supplier doesn't come through on time with what he's supposed to approve the contract?
You can sue him now. You can
get an economic sanction?
Yeah.
You measure the
I
I don't know. I've never read anything that indicates that's the way they do it. What they just talk about is you take him to court, you sue him for breach of contract, and then there's a fine that's levied against him.
Yeah,
you can get part of the fine anyway. I know you can get part of the fine. You can recover some damages. The trouble is, you know, an economic system hangs together, and you can't really introduce changes in one part without introducing unwillingly changes in other parts that you hadn't even contemplated. And that's why an economic system tends to go toward these extremes of either, you know, 95% or 5%. You either have to basically organize the economy by the market system with kinds of powers of enterprises to sue and be sued, you know, establish the contractual relationships and all that, and let the enterprises, through bargaining in the market and outside of the market, establish, make all of these decisions and establish the context for decisions. Either you have to do that, or you've got to have somebody in central command passing out all the orders. And there, you just can't mix the two. And
one of the worst myths that we have, we always like this idea, is that the truth is in the middle. Don't be an extremist. It seems to me that there are two economic systems that work. One is socialism and one is capitalism. And there's one that doesn't work, and that's a mixed version. We a lot of our hope for the convergence of the Soviet and American systems is rooted in this myth. You know, there must be some way of taking the best from each system. Well, I'm sure there's a way to take the best from each system, but I don't think it can give us something in the middle. As I always say, the English drive on the left-hand side of the road, and the French drive on the right. And the truth does not lie in the middle. Well, it's time for coffee break, so get over there and grab your goodies.